the SNL Hall of Fame podcast with chief conversationalist Bill Kenny, featuring Matt Ardill, with special guest Gary C. And now, curator of the hall, your host, J.D.
Thank you so much, Kirk Lane. It is an absolute thrill to be here with you all just outside the SNL Hall of Fame. I am getting ready to go in. Keys are jingling. Flip-flops are on. And yours are too. Just because it's spring, baby, doesn't mean you get to wear your flip-flops inside. That's right. Wipe them. The SNL Hall of Fame podcast is a weekly affair where each episode we take a deep dive into the career of a former cast member, host, musical guest, or writer, and add them to the ballot for your consideration. Once the nominations have been announced, we turn to you, the listener, to help decide who will be enshrined for perpetuity inside the hall. And that's how we play the game. It's just that simple. Hey, listen, I got to tell you, we have had some dates dissipate on us as a result of taking a week off, a hiatus, as it were, or a biatus, because we were saying bye, because it's the seventh season, the last season. So the new voting dates are forthcoming, and they are exactly this. They start on Monday, May 18th, or pardon me, Sunday, May 18th, and it will run all the way through to May 29th, Friday, May 29th at 11:59 p.m. So you're going to want to get your vote on. You have unlimited ballots to suggest this year. Of course, we're getting ready for our Season 7 Roundtable, which is always a hit around these parts. And then we're going to wrap everything up with a class of Season 7 live stream, lots of special guests. It's going to be a real pleasure to do that and say goodbye to all of you as we do.
All right, I am walking down the hallway today in only a white long sleeve shirt and my boxers and a pair of sunglasses. That's right, it's risky business. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm feeling good, like some old time rock and roll.
That's right, baby.
JD, how are you doing?
I've never been better. Never.
Excellent. Well, when you're free and breezy, you always feel great. Ready to hear a bit about Tom Schiller?
I would love to. I know very little.
Right. Yeah. He is 5'10", born April 12th, 1949 in Los Angeles, California. He is the son of I Love Lucy writer Bob Schiller. He began his career as an assistant documentarian, Robert Snyder. And he went on to direct a film about his mentor, Henry Miller. He has directed over 500 comedic TV commercials. He kind of pioneered that hidden camera style commercial and owns a production company, Schiller Vision. He recorded an album called Tom and Don, a series of improv interviews between himself and musician Donald Fagen. He is played in the Saturday Night film by Parker Weirling. He holds 14 writing credits, 8 acting credits, 17 directing credits, and over 500 commercial credits. He would frequently crash on Lauren's couch during the early days of Saturday Night Live, where he would frequently complain about Paul Simon and Mick Jagger constantly hanging out with Lauren, once saying, "I just kept praying that Mick Jagger would leave so I could go to sleep on the couch." Tom Schiller.
Well, I think that's great. And, we're going to learn a little bit more once Bill turns off that air popper downstairs. Bill, turn that sucker off. It's a little loud. He's down there with Gary Seath right now, and they are going to learn us more about Tom Schiller. So let's take it away.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Matt and JD. Welcome into the conversation. My name is Bill Kenny. We are here today to discuss one of the more unique writers in the history of SNL, Tom Schiller. I'm so excited to be joined by the co-host of the Not Ready for Primetime project, Gary Seeth. Gary, how are you today?
Oh, Bill, I'm doing very well. I'm really excited to talk about Tom Schiller. I'm very excited to talk to you on the Hall of Fame. I think taking this over from Thomas, you've been doing great. It's been so much fun to listen to you and all these conversations. So I'm just happy to be back and be a part of it.
I appreciate that. Yeah, you've been here nominating other writers before. You were here for O'Donohue and Zweibel. And no luck, unfortunately, because the voters just can't figure out how to vote for writers. But we've got another one on the ballot today. What's your take on Schiller to start out with here?
Well, I think it's fascinating. I think Tom Schiller is one of the more interesting people that have ever worked on the show. And nominated him as a writer, even. I was like, well, he's done so much for the show that's more than just a writer, I think. But he's such a fascinating individual with a terribly interesting personal story of, you know, growing up in Hollywood, and his dad was a famous writer. Tom Schiller is a person that I love his work. I love his sketches. And I'm really excited to talk about him because I feel like there's so much to talk about. We can go in so many different directions with this.
Definitely. Before we do, I want to say, what do you have going on over at the Not Ready for Primetime project?
So we have a bunch of stuff coming up. We actually, in the next couple of weeks or soon, we have an interview with Rosie Schuster that we did. That was excellent. She's a lot of fun. We also have an interview with Jeff Richards coming up. We're still working on season 4, getting through the early years of SNL. And we have a Bill Swirsky's tournament talk around recurring characters. So we're going to count down the top recurring characters as well. So a lot going on over at the Not Ready for Primetime project that Brad and I are hard at work on constantly.
Yeah, you guys have been doing a great job. I was just on one of the tournament talks. Yes. We got to talk about music and make fun of Brad for Paul Simon and
I know
even though he's not the Paul Simon hater.
It's like, they gave me crap for Paul Simon and you're the one who hates Paul Simon. I was like, I don't know what you want me to do.
To be fair, I did not make fun of him for Paul Simon, but others did, and it was pretty funny. So please go back and listen to that one as well.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, so Tom Schiller, as we said, you know, comes kind of in right at the very beginning, the original era, joins right from the start. And, you know, SNL, one of the things that's been a through line throughout the history of the show is short films. So right from the start, we get Albert Brooks, followed soon by Gary Weiss. Tom Schiller eventually takes this over, and these are three very unique voices in the early days. Gary, as someone who's been watching these episodes fresh in your mind, what's the big difference between these three?
Well, that's a very good question, Bill. And I love Schiller's reels. And I feel like, you know, Albert Brooks, the films that Albert Brooks did were very Albert Brooksy. They were, you know, I constantly felt like he was trying for something and he would always run out of time. And so I always felt like his pieces weren't really made. The time frame he had to work on them wasn't really right for him. Gary Weiss did a lot of interesting things, real world things, where he would go to like a prop shop and interview the woman who ran this prop shop forever. And just try to find these interesting characters or put hosts in interesting situations. Buck Henry was a great one, interviewing sanitation workers. And he did some interesting pieces. But Tom Schiller's reels that he did in those first 5 years are very unique because they're like short films that he put a lot of time and love and care into. And they're just so well put together. And this is what Tom Schiller wanted to do. He wanted to be a filmmaker. He wanted to be a European filmmaker, was like his ideal situation. And having the opportunity to do it for SNL in those first few years, I feel like he really took the work seriously Not that Albert Brooks and Gary Weiss didn't, because they were very different filmmakers. But what Tom Schiller did was so thoughtful, I think. And you see that in the pieces he did in the early years of Schiller's Reels. I mean, this is a guy who, like, he grew up in a show business family. His dad was a writer for I Love Lucy and Flip Wilson and all these other shows. And, you know, on family vacations, they would take their little, I forget if it was 8 or 16 millimeter camera. And instead of just shooting, like, you know, old school family trips of like, oh, here we are at the beach or whatever, they actually would like write and script things out and then act them out as a family on their vacation. Yeah. So Tom has done this his entire life. And when it comes time for him to actually do it for SNL, you see he's familiar with this process and he knows how to do it and what he's doing. And he just does it so well.
He really does. I think one of the big differences to me, especially I'm rewatching from the beginning with my daughter, my teenage daughter wanted to watch, which is a rough go, as you know. Some of it does not age well. Some of it doesn't make a lot of sense, even to an old fart like me trying to explain jokes that are on Weekend Update.
Right.
I think the big difference, these age very well. So the fact that he sets them in different times, whether it's the 30s or the 60s, they really age well. Where in Albert Brooks' film, not so much. Gary Weiss, some of them.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I think the Homeward Bound for Gary Weiss is one that kind of sticks out as something that still holds up today. But there's a lot that is just kind of stuck in the 70s where you could see this having a Schiller's Reel being made in 1998 or 2003 and it not being shocking that, you know, it's of its own time.
There's a timelessness to it. If you look at something like La Dolce Gilda, it's clearly modeled after Fellini and the Italian filmmakers of the 50s and 60s. And you know that, but it doesn't make it feel old. Like it's something that personally, it's probably my favorite Schiller's Reel. Okay. And it's one that just is so well done and does exactly what he wants to do. It puts you in that time frame of those Italian films. And I think Gilda's the perfect person for that. Like she's brilliant in it. And
yeah,
that to me is just one where he's so good at doing this.
Come here. Come closer. You know I love you, my little monkeys. But leave me my dreams. Dreams are like paper. They tear so easily. I love to play. Every time I play, you win. Ciao.
This is one that came out. That's only the fourth one he did, season three. And as you said, it is based on Fellini films, which... Yeah, maybe the kids today aren't watching Fellini, but you can still get the sense of how well this is made.
Yeah, and what I loved about this film is when he made this, he had the script and everything worked out for himself. He had the actors come to this bar. They just shot it in a bar late night. And instead of giving everyone a script, he gave everyone their lines on index cards and just said, you know, when I shoot you, this is what I want you to say. So they didn't get wrapped up in everything that was going on. And the way in which he shoots it too, it's like it's just so well crafted, the way it's shot and then cut together, and the way he brings in Dan and John and Buck Henry has a little piece in there. And it's so well done and thought out. And then he makes Gilda stay up all night so they can shoot her at sunrise, and then I read that he said, you know, after the fact he realized he could have done it at sunset and not wasted her entire night, and he felt bad about it. But it's just such a great piece, and it's so I don't know, it just kind of, you know, and the way it highlights Gilda, I think is also the part where everyone just you fall in love with Gilda in that piece. Yeah. And it's so easy to do because it's so well done.
And to that point, I think one of the two of the running themes that we'll have here is a lot of his films highlight one cast member and kind of put the spotlight on them, which we see from Kevin all the way to Kevin Nealon, Norm Macdonald, and we start here with Gilda. And another theme that we get is that every time someone sadly passes, especially before their time, it's something that's aired. A Schiller's Reel is almost guaranteed. Yeah. If one of the cast members was in it, it's going to be shown. And this was shown, we just talked about this on your show, SNL 15.
Right.
This was something that was shown. And it was one of those wow moments when they gave the dedication to Gilda, who had just died a few months earlier. And this was the way they ended her tribute. It just speaks volumes to how well this was done.
It speaks to the heart that Tom Schiller brings across in these. I mean, obviously, Don't Look Back in Anger is a piece that they just showed it in its entirety at the 50th for a reason, right? I mean, this is that is another wonderful piece that he does, highlights Belushi, but he talks about all of the cast members from the first five seasons in there. Well, four. And again, this is something that he just sees. He sees what John can do and wants to do that on film and do something different with it. So, you know, it's Belushi at 90 was originally the original idea for this, and he goes and does it. And the performance that he pulls out of Belushi, Brad, this is one of Brad's favorite pieces of Belushi's, because at the end, just the look that Belushi gives to the camera before he starts dancing, just it pulls you right in. And it's just like, oh yeah, I know that guy. I'm going to fall in love with this guy too. And it's just so well done. He's just, I just find him to be so fascinating because of his brilliance.
The Saturday Night Show was the best experience of my life. And now they're all gone. And I miss every one of them. Why me? Why did I live so long? They're all dead. I'll tell you why. Because I'm a dancer.
When you meet them, Mr. King, you
Yeah, and you know, the narrative has obviously become because John died so early. But, you know, they kind of overlooked the fact that most of them were on drugs. Most of them were living hard. This could have been anybody. And the fact that it just kind of turned out that this was the way they decided to go. Talking about all the other Not Ready for Primetime players dying in their 30s, mostly. And yeah, to have Belushi in that cemetery, as you said, SNL 50, which as great as it was, we got so many documentaries, so many different things that were going on around the show. The show itself didn't lean into old clips. We didn't get very much. And this was one of the few and the only one in its entirety introduced by Garrett Morris, which was just such a beautiful moment to see that man sitting on stage to introduce a film that has stood
really
the test
has.
Of time.
And again, like you were saying, it doesn't feel like something that was done in the 70s. I mean, part of it is it's shot on real film. So all of these pieces that he did in the in the early parts for Schiller's Reels were shot on film. And this is shot in black and white. A lot of them were. And it just gives that timelessness to it, as well as the subject matter that he's doing and talking about.
Yeah, a lot of them are in black and white, and I think that does lend to the timelessness that so many of them are in that kind of don't know when it was made, and that doesn't really matter when it was made. Another one that I really like, I wonder what you think of this one, Java Junkie. So this was one that was done in season five, and it was the rare chance to show off Peter Aykroyd, who had become a feature player. And it's kind of made in, you know, when I was, you know, in my teens, early 20s, I loved watching early 60s films, like these quick cut movies like this. And this is what this leans into. He's obsessed with coffee. And, you know, you have these quick cuts of all these different coffee shops. he becomes obsessed with it and eventually goes into a mental institution, right, which is Maxwell House.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Yeah, it was strange. I had no appetite. Just wanted coffee. Pure black coffee. I kept thinking about Betty and the look on her face when she said goodbye. I ordered a second cup. Tasted good. Then I ordered a third and a fourth until I couldn't stop. Couldn't control myself.
It's like, it's got that absurdity to it, because I think some of Schiller's work and some of his sketches, apparent, obviously, that we'll talk about later, there is an absurdist element to it. And Java Junkie, I think, is great in calling back to those films from the early 60s, like you were talking about, in this absurdist way. I think, honestly, this is probably my favorite thing Peter Aykroyd has ever done, aside from voicing Peter Venkman in the Ghostbusters cartoon.
Yes.
Yeah, this, and again, it's so well done, and it's so simple is not the right word, but it's not a complex shoot. You know, if you break it down as to how they shot it and all, it's really straightforward, and it's just the way that he then goes in and edits it, and it's just like you said, it's like fast cuts, and you get this scent, this, you get that nervous energy that people get from drinking too much coffee in the short film itself, because it's so well done. Yeah, I love Java Junkie.
Yeah, season 5 is interesting. You guys are headed there on your show, so it'll be fun to listen to what you have to say about there, because there's a lot of good Schiller's reels this year. If you can't say anything else about season 5, this is one of the things that stands out. Java Junkie is definitely
I agree. I also like the Lyndon Palmer film, which, not as much as Java Junkie, but season 5, that's up there as one of the Schiller's reels that I enjoy.
Yeah, and another very short one that he does. This was very charming. He was a director who had worked with Marilyn and Charlie Chaplin, right? Yeah. But yeah, this was another fun one. Hollywood's forgotten director. Yeah,
that in was season good.
5.
What was interesting about Schiller's reels is, you know, we had gone through the Albert Brooks phase and he did his handful, and then we got a long stretch of Gary Weiss films, good and bad, not to say anything about Gary Weiss, but we had a lot of Gary Weiss films, and then we get out of nowhere a Schiller's reel, which the first one was The Acid Generation. Do you remember this one? This is so funny. Yes. Because it's The Acid Generation, Where Are They Now? This is late 70s, right? So The Acid Generation is only 10 years before, but this is all interviews with senior citizens where Schiller just went and paid people $25 to read what was on the cue cards. And you have these old people talking about how, you know, I was on a trip for 3 days straight. I just kept doing drugs. And like, it was hilarious. And it was a great entry into Schiller's reels and kind of what was coming up. And it's just, I think it's another one that I absolutely love. I think it's so funny.
The hippies who dropped acid and dropped out. But where are they now, the survivors of the 60s? Where are their heads at? And just how much do they remember today?
The 60s were beautiful. I hit every day. I was high for about 3 years. I couldn't get my head together, so I dropped out.
Yes, I was a love child in the 60s. And it was a beautiful, far-out trip.
I remember Hendrix at Monterey as if it was yesterday.
You just can't get good acid these days.
Yeah, we spoke about how timeless they are. This one's not timeless because made today, they would actually be almost 80, and it would be funny in that regard. But yeah, like I remember Hendrix and Monterey. Like Monterey was like 8 years before this, and like they're all just sitting around the senior home and a pool and things like that. So yeah, this was a lot of fun. I always try to put myself in the mindset of people in this time, and you know, this predates me. I was a young child, believe it or not. And I wonder somebody who's watching season 3, who's gone through the Albert Brooks and the Gary Weisses of it all, what they're thinking,
right,
seeing something like this. This is so different. Albert Brooks' films were so long sometimes that he had to split them into two episodes. These were two, yeah. 3 minute beats, boom, 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 in, out, move on. And so much of the rest of the show was like that at this point. You know, these very short sketches. This was a good way to kind of fit in with the rest of the show.
It really was. And it's so, and you're right. It fits into that episode so well, where it's just kind of seamless and, you know, it's a Schiller's reel cause they have the card up, but it fits in with everything else that the show is at that point.
Another one I love from this era, which I don't know if it's a deep cut, but maybe they're all deep cuts other than the ones that are shown still to this day. Yeah. Roman Holiday, which is one that doesn't have any cast in it. It's filmed as a vacation film would have been made at this point on an old camera. And it's voiced over by this older lady who's on holiday with her husband, Roman. And take it from there, Gary. Poor, what happens to
poor Roman? We see Roman carrying the luggage and everything, and he's like panting heavily and he's definitely tired, and poor Roman dies. And then the woman becomes taken by this young Italian man. And then she's vacationing with him at the end of her vacation film. She's taken up with this young Italian guy because Roman has died.
Yes. Yeah. And Roman dies in his
suit. That's right. Yes.
In the middle of the filming. Yes. And eventually she marries Tony the dancer on Roman's life insurance policy. And I'm sure he would have. Oh,
arrivederci, Roman. That's.
Yeah. O'Donohue gets all the credit for the dark stuff in this era, but this is pretty dark.
It's interesting. You know, there's the wonderful book, Nothing Lost Forever, by Michael Streeter, who has been on our podcast, is wonderful. He talks about the Michael O'Donohue and Tom Schiller are both, if you think about Michael O'Donohue being like the counterculture writer of the first few years of SNL, well, he says Tom Schiller is the counterculture. Like, he's so different than what is mainstream in America. And he's so different from O'Donohue. He's even counter to that. So he really brings his own sensibility to things. And some of it is dark, but in a much different way than O'Donohue too, because there's still a lightness about it, an absurdity.
So anything else, Gary, before we move on to other eras of Schiller that you want to touch on as far as the original era?
Yeah, we could talk about all of those Schiller's reels from the early era, and they're all great, but I think we hit on the most important ones to me anyway.
Yeah, so he leaves with the rest of the crew after season five, and there's an interesting footnote here that we can get into. This might be the best place to talk about it, where and it's in the new Lorne book, as well as the book that you just pointed out by Michael, where Lorne has this contract with MGM to make movies, and they can't really seem to come to an agreement on what should be done after he leaves SNL for the first time. And eventually it lands on Schiller, who's making a movie, Nothing Lasts Forever. So you want to speak a little bit to that as far as what happened with that movie?
You know, I don't know the in-depth of this, to be honest with you. Like, I know that it all just went awry, and I'm not as well-versed on that piece of it all, to be honest.
Well, basically, Lorne had promised MGM, you know, SNL stars and this and that, and Schiller's making this art film, which is being propped as a comedy film. He's got Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray, even though they're under contract to different studios. He can't even promote the film with those two names. So MGM is under the illusion that this is going to be a buddy comedy, and it turns out to be this very artsy film. Kind of disappears. No. It's never released. And eventually, I think in the last few years, I think TCM put it on, and now it's online. I just watched it about a year or two ago, and it is not a comedy. It's very artsy. Zach Galligan's in it. There's a lot of cameos from different people. Aykroyd and Murray have small roles, but it doesn't really, it's obvious where MGM was like,
right,
wait a minute. we thought we were getting the not ready for primetime players, and you're giving us this hour and a half art piece. And it's one of those, it was, before it was released, it was kind of like the Rosetta Stone of movies. Like SNL completists were like,
right,
we need to see this movie because nobody had seen it for 35, 40
and
years.
And it is an interesting thing because Tom was doing what Tom always wanted to do. And he felt like, I've done that to a degree, you know, like he was like, I did that. Now I want to do the thing that I set out to do in the beginning before I got roped into coming to New York from LA with Lorne. And so I know there was friction then between Lorne and Tom for a little while because of this. And I just, it's one of those things where being a fan of Tom's films, I'm so sad for him that this didn't, that he did what he wanted to do and then he wasn't able to take it anywhere because of issues out of his control, really.
Yeah, and I do recommend, I'm not going to say it's a great film. It can be a little dry, but if you are a fan of SNL, if you're a fan of the people involved with SNL, especially in the early years, I do recommend going out and trying to find this because it is an interesting side note to everything that was going on from the time Lorne left until he came back. But eventually Lorne does come back and a lot of the writers follow, not as long as they were for the first era, but we do get Schiller, who does come back for a long time here. Where should we start with Schiller's renaissance on SNL?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting because Schiller comes back as a writer / filmmaker for SNL, and they hadn't had an in-house filmmaker for many years at this point. So when he comes back to do it, he's kind of the opinion that, all right, I'm going to get to do my Schiller's reels again. And then because it's the late 80s, they're like, oh, hey, by the way, you're not doing these on film any longer. So you're doing this on video. Your budgets are much smaller. And in reading about this time, I kind of get frustrated for him. But Schiller... Yeah. Doesn't see it that way. He's like, okay, we'll work with this and I'll use this to my advantage. And he spends more time on set decoration and set dressing and costuming and things rather than film. And he kind of plays with the video in different ways to make his new, what Schiller's reels and then Schiller Vision. And it starts, Bill, with one of the best that I'm sure you love, right? Love is a Dream.
Yeah.
Again,
right.
I think he knocks out of the park with the Acid Generation being his first Schiller's reel in 77. Then he comes back, and in 1988, they debut Love is a Dream with Phil Hartman and Jan Hooks, which is so, again, it's one of those pieces that they've shown to highlight the unfortunate passing of these cast members because it brings across these performers in such a different light than we see them in the sketches every week. And the performances in Love is a Dream are just, there's no dialogue or very little dialogue in that. And what Jan Hooks and Phil Hartman are able to do is phenomenal. And it's beautiful. And you love it, right?
Oh, it's so beautiful. If I had a top three of things that still make me tear up from SNL, this is number one with a bullet, not even close. I watched it three times in the lead up to talking to you, and it gets me every time. And not only because, as you said, the sad passing of both of these incredible cast members, but it's so beautifully done. It's so outside the box of what we get, even for films. It starts in a bank. An older lady is going through her safe deposit box and finds an old crown, and it turns from black and white to color. And she's a younger lady with Phil Hartman, and Phil is lip syncing from a Bing Crosby movie, The Emperor's Waltz, and which is a deep cut, even if you're a Bing Crosby head, which I don't know if anybody is, but if you are, this is a deep cut. But it's he does this so well. Jan's lyrics, I don't know if you know this, Gary,
yeah,
were made just for this and sung by a huge Broadway star at the time, Patricia Norcia. And she lip syncs this and they add it together. They have this beautiful dance and it eventually ends with Jan leaving the bank and the security guard is an old Phil Hartman. It's so unbelievable. Like it's just such a great piece in the second golden
era. And this is an idea that Schiller had as a teenager. And it's just one that he sat on and couldn't quite put it together for a long time, but it's something that he came up with as a kid. Just this idea that a woman would put on a tiara and turn into a princess and have a dance. It's
like he was a teenager. I was throwing rocks and watching baseball, and this guy's coming up with unbelievable. But yeah, and as you said, you know, this is another piece that they show in memoriam. The last time we get most of the second Golden Era cast together, SNL 25, they're all on stage. Phil has just passed, and they're giving a tribute, and Jan speaks to it. And then when Jan passes in 2014, Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig on that Saturday night show introduce this. So, it's just another piece that stood the test of time and points out what wonderful actors these people are beyond being comedians. Yeah.
And Schiller captures that so brilliantly again. You know, it's wonderful.
Yes. Where should we go next? Now, there's a couple I want to make sure we get to, but I'm interested in.
Well, it's interesting because his time now on his second stint on SNL, you know, he actually stops writing sketches after I think two seasons because just he wasn't getting stuff on, and there were like 20 writers as opposed to the 10 when he was on the first stint. But he continues to make films, and what's interesting about this is that only half of his films that he makes get on air. So he's not getting as much going, but the things that he does get on are interesting and different. Sadly, I think he has this great idea for a four-part series called Broadway Story. And the first two parts aired. The third part doesn't air, but it's put into like cable packages for one-hour shows. So it's broadcast at some point. And the fourth one never has been shown. But he's making these larger pieces now that are, you know, supposed to be runners throughout the season that you would see. And that actually starred the entire cast of that season. I think it was 89-90 season, I think it was, or 88-89.
Yes.
And it was this whole story about Broadway. And it included, you know, like Lovitz as a theater owner, I think. And Jan Hooks and Nora Dunn were in it. Like that whole cast was in it in different ways. And it's really unfortunate that we weren't able to see the whole piece all the way through because I guess they didn't like the third and fourth parts as much as we wanted them to. And by they, I mean Lauren.
Yeah. Right. The sad thing is that if this was today, it would be on YouTube the next day, even if it didn't make it to air. They do that with Please Don't Destroy. They've done that with a lot of different pre-tapes. If it doesn't make it to air, they still put it online. And I think that would be the case for something like this. This one's interesting because, as you said, it's a multi-episode arc, which SNL doesn't do, especially in the Lauren eras. Like this is an Ebersol move where you would get something like this to have it. And it wasn't even the next week. I think the second one was like three weeks after. So there was a little gap there between parts one and two. As you said, the third one does eventually get put into packages when they're replacing things. And yeah, this is a great showcase to everybody. The tribute to 1930 cinema, you know, all this fake stuff being put over stock footage. I love this one. This is, you know, this is my era. So I love getting to see all of these people play in a different
sandbox. Oh, what I love about it is it's the perfect vehicle for John Lovitz and Phil Hartman at this time. Like they fit these roles in that world so brilliantly.
Yeah. Another one that I love is this kind of a spiritual successor to Java Junkie is Hooked on Sushi. And this is season 15. We get Kevin Nealon in a solo piece, basically. And he walks into this dark, dank restaurant and orders the special. And Gary, do you remember this one?
This one.
I didn't know one piece of raw fish from another, so I took a chance on the special.
I'll try the special sushi.
You want the special sushi?
Yeah, special sushi.
Okay, special sushi. Hey, dozo.
What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Yeah, so he basically he walks in. It's a voiceover, much like the Peter Ackroyd one was for Java Junkie. He's a businessman walking around the city. He walks into the sushi joint and he asks for the special sushi. There's suspenseful music, and the people who run the restaurant hook him with a fish hook and turn him into the special sushi. We end with eyeballs and hands in the display case. So it takes a very dark
Again, turn. He can do dark in this like fun, absurdist way, right? And it's not so heavy.
Right.
Yeah, he's so good.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin was so great at these absurd characters. Here he's playing it more of like film noir, guy walking around the city. And yeah, I love this. I love, again, getting to showcase one cast member in a piece where they didn't get stuff like that in live.
Yeah,
sketches.
It really speaks to how he's able to do so many things with so many different people and just kind of say like, oh, you know, Kevin, you would be good for this. And he does one with Bill that we didn't talk about. It was interesting to me in doing the research for this, Bill. I was surprised how few Schiller Visions actually aired. I think it's just because in my mind, it's like there were Schiller's Reels and then there was Schiller Vision. And then when I realized how few of them, only four of the Schiller Vision actually aired in that time frame. And then they brought back Schiller's Reels after again. But it was funny to me. I assumed it was more than the four that it had been.
Yeah, I think it is the Mandela effect of thinking that there were more, absolutely. One we have to touch on, which being a certain age, this was one of those that I quoted more than Matt Foley, more than a lot of other Farley characters. Hidden Camera.
Oh, this and this really is, Bill, this is taking something from that time period, which Schiller didn't do often, but he does it so brilliantly where they switch out Chris Farley's coffee with dehydrated coffee crystals, and they tell him on camera, and it's Tom Schiller plays the filmmaker who tells Farley, and Chris Farley flips out, and it is so good.
Sir, do you realize that you are not drinking regular coffee, but Colombian decaffeinated coffee crystals?
What?
I said, you're drinking Colombian decaf coffee crystals.
You son of a bitch! You no good damn son of a bitch!
Again, like seeing what Chris Farley can do and saying this would be really funny to put him in this situation and the way in which they execute on it is great, because this is something that you could have done this live, right? Like, this could have been a live sketch, but doing it on film as a pre-tape, it's so much better, because it just, the way in which Farley explodes and goes on, and it becomes just chaos all around. It's so much fun.
And it is of the time, but I think if I showed this to someone who hadn't seen SNL, who was younger, I think this would still play. It is based on the Folgers Crystals commercials, which were ubiquitous at the time with, you know, we've replaced your expensive coffee with this shitty instant coffee. And people are just sitting in restaurants going, oh, really? That's crazy. And yeah, as you said, Farley, this is such a beautiful turn for him. You son of a bitch.
Just the look that he gets when he's just like this moment of confusion at first, and then you see it turn to anger. Like, the way that Farley does that is amazing.
So great. And if it ended there, it'd be fine, but they actually follow up with him and talk about, how do you feel about this? Angry. And it's, you know, his whole head is shrouded in bandages. And I would put this on any Farley best of. Like, this is up there with all of his famous
characters. So. And I think it's one that, like you were saying, stands the test of time. This isn't one that, you know, you age out of, and you like, if you're not familiar with anything, it's funny regardless of what you know or don't know.
Now, is there any other ones that you want to touch on before we talk about some of his other sketches?
I always, again, it's our age, but I really enjoyed Dieter's Dream.
Hallo Dieter, du bist abseits der Ehe.
Also.
Hallo Dieter, du bist abseits meiner Dreamer. Yes! Also.
Again, it's this European sensibility that Tom Schiller has, and the Dieter character that Mike Myers had. It's kind of like putting them together, marrying those two ideas, those concepts, makes total sense. And I always liked the Dieter character, so I really loved that. I thought it was just such a fun piece.
It's so rare for SNL to take a character from some one place and put them somewhere else. You know, we've gotten things like Stefan that started in a live sketch, went to Weekend Update. But to go from live sketches to pre-tapes, to a film. And he does this twice with Dieter. So this is Dieter in Space, and then there's Dieter's Dream. I think Dieter's Dream is probably stronger. But yeah, you get he's asleep in the audience at SNL, and you get a Marv Albert cameo. Like, okay. Miranda Richardson, who was probably forgotten to many now, but in wearing one of the most provocative outfits ever on
SNL. She was the host of that episode, I think, right? Yeah.
She was. Yeah. Yeah. And it ends with the monkey where Dieter's privates should be. And he gets to say his famous line, touch my monkey. Like, a little on the nose, but okay.
But it's just,
I enjoy this too.
I don't know. Everything about it, again, I like the absurd stuff, and I think this was one that hit on the absurdity mixed with Schiller's sensibilities. It's really well done.
Yeah, well, and with recurring characters, with that, which at this point in the show were overdone a lot of the time, to get actual world building. We're not just, you know, doing the same bit by bit. You're taking them out of their comfort zone and putting them somewhere else, I think is a really interesting.
Even the way that starts with Dieter in the audience of SNL, and he's bored. Yeah. So he's falling asleep watching the show. He's like, huh.
Love it. Yeah, this is one of my favorite Mike pieces as well. So eventually we get less and less of Schiller. We get one more in season 19 with Norm Macdonald. We'll work for food. And again, it's another one of those that's really kind of heartwarming. He's a hobo, Gary, and he eventually gives his hot dog to another hobo. I'm not doing it justice with this explanation, but
no, but I keep coming back to the same arguments though. Schiller sees, I guess, like the humanity in these performers, in these actors, and puts them in situations where it's kind of absurd. It's also kind of sad, but the just like the humanity that Norm brings to this is so fascinating. It's not one you would think of for Norm.
Yeah, and it's pretty early on in Norm's career on SNL too. So we don't get the Norm of it all at this point, but yeah, it is. It's very, very interesting to see. As far as other written sketches, let's talk about that briefly. We get going back to the original era. There's some really good pieces that he did that weren't films. Is there anything that sticks out to you, Gary, that you want to?
Yeah, I think one of the, well, you know, I think one of the things that is so amazing about Tom Schiller is that, you know, he was hired. He knew Lauren from LA. He was introduced by his dad. So he was hired initially as Lauren's assistant. And he's just bopping around the offices as they're putting this show together. And then it becomes apparent to everybody that, like, oh, this guy's funny and he can write. And he gets something on air on the first episode with Try Open, which is, it's a hilarious commercial for an arthritis medication. And it's just one shot of hands trying to open this bottle of medicine, which describing it doesn't do it justice, because you have to watch it and listen at the same time and watch the hands getting frustrated because they have arthritis and they can't open this bottle of medicine. It's really well done. And I love that piece. That was one that I forgot about until we rewatched the first season. And I was like, oh yeah, this is hilarious.
Yeah. One of the first commercial parodies we get. I think it ages pretty well. I think the joke here at this point in 1975 is that child safety locks were brand new. So, you know, most medicine kids, you could open easily. Your 2-year-old could go in and open your Percocet or your, and there was no, until a couple of kids died and they said, oh, well, maybe we shouldn't leave it like that. So we're right at the verge of this kind of becoming a new thing. And yeah, to not even have an actor in it, just to have the hands, the George Coe voiceover, and it's
George Coe voiceover, Chevy Chase's hands, written by Tom Schiller. Simple,
yep,
yeah, so good.
Yeah, another one that I like, and this one probably doesn't age. I love I don't even know how to say it. The
Decibet.
Yeah, Decibet. Yeah. At the time, they were trying to convert U.S. into the metric system. I have faint memories of this, Gary, with this being a big deal. And, you know, the joke here is that not only are they going to change measurements and things like that, but they're going to change the alphabet. We get Dan as the pitchman of all pitchmen, and he's talking about how we're getting down to 10 letters.
Yeah. And this is a brilliantly written piece that could only be performed by Dan.
In the EF grouping edition, the word eagle would remain basically the same in character, but would be pronounced Ethaglev. However, certain words previously beginning with the letter F, like fish, would be pronounced with an additional E sound. Thus, the sentence, I caught a big fish, would read, I caught a biggie fish. The GHI grouping character might include these examples, goat, would remain goat. Gotel will carry the G letter addition, but as in many words beginning with the GH sound, as in Ghana, the G will remain silent, thus hotel. However, words beginning with I, like industry, would be pronounced gindustry.
No one else could do this justice, because Dan can speak quickly and he can enunciate while he's speaking quickly. And that's the only way that this bit works.
I can't even say, I don't know, Alamon Open. Like, that's hard to say. And he's saying it live and quickly, as she said, in a brilliant, brilliant way.
And then they do this, they bring this back, right? For the leisure week, they do it with the days of the week, and they're going to make it.
Yes.
Again, it's absurd. And it's one of these, having watched these sketches where they sat in the shows recently, I can tell you that you're kind of taken out of things. And all of a sudden you're like, what the hell is going on? Oh, okay. This is a thing. I get it now. So I can't imagine watching this live in 1977 and just kind of trying to figure out what is going on. And both of these were early, right? This season one or two.
Yeah. Season one. And then the second one was season two.
And this is a time where, you know, you're not always getting a set formula for the show. So when you see Dan to camera, you know you're getting a pitch here. And for the pitch to be, you know, the government wants to change the alphabet, like we're trying to do with the metric system, is just so, it's brilliant. It's really well done.
The way that Dan says the trash letters. So everything from peon. Which eventually pays off with the stop sign that has all these squished together letters. The big recurring sketch that he had at this time, Gary, was all the bad, the ones from the bad series. And this is kind of an underrated Dan character, Leonard Pinth Garnell, where they'd go from different things, conceptual theater, opera, cinema. This was something they did a lot of. Are you a fan of these, having rewatched a lot of these recently?
I'm a fan of certain ones. I'm generally always a fan of Dan's performance as Leonard Pinth Garnell introducing the bad, whatever it is. And then from there, it's situational, I think. But the overall concept of these, I really enjoy. And I really enjoy Dan's performance. And you can see, you know, Schiller has said that Dan was always his favorite to write for because he was so versatile and able to do so many things and create real characters from these, you know, from whatever he wrote. And you can see that with Leonard Pinth Garnell, where this is something, this is a character that Dan gets behind and really, you know, brings to life. And just, it's something that he truly believes that what he's about to show you is important to show you, even though it's really bad. And just, like, the idea behind that is so great because, like, I want to show you this thing that's horrible, but it's very important that you see it. Yeah, those are great.
Yeah, the way that Dan would always wrap these up and say something along, that wasn't so good, was it? And then eventually throwing the script on fire into the garbage.
With his little accent that he would put on it. Yeah.
So, yeah, and one last footnote that we have to talk about here with Schiller. He is a featured player for one episode.
That's right.
So, you know, if you want to put him in a group with Laurie Metcalf and Emily Prager, that wouldn't be fair because he's featured as many of the writers are from this era in so many other episodes. But he does have the one where he is in the opening credits.
That's right.
In season five.
But he's on a lot. I mean, he does get a lot of airtime throughout. He does a great Desi Arnaz impression. Again, he grew up, his dad was a writer for the I Love Lucy show. So he knew these people. And his Desi with Gilda's Lucy, they're both so good. So he got a lot of airtime as Desi Arnaz, which was fun.
Yeah, funny enough, as I said, I'm rewatching from the beginning with my daughter, and we just watched the Desi Arnaz episode, and it's so great to see the take that he has on it. When they do the whole, and this was written by Schiller as well, the whole I Love Lucy pitch ideas before they came up with I Love Lucy, I Love Asparagus, and I Loathe Lucy. And eventually they do I Love Desi, and Desi Arnaz Jr. is there. And they're both doing, it's like a dueling Desi.
It's so funny. That's so good. He's so good.
So, I mean, we have post-SNL. It's hard to say. I mean, he does hundreds of commercials, real commercials, not SNL commercials. Obviously, we talked about Nothing Lasts Forever, but, you know, he kind of fades away as far as memory for SNL. Do you think his legacy holds up? I mean, he hasn't done anything on the show since season 19.
That is true.
Do you think it's...
But here's my argument for Tom Schiller, Bill. I think, you know, he played a hand in the creation of this show, right? Like I said, he became friends with Lorne at a time where Lorne had already talked to Dick Ebersol and agreed to do the show. They go to Joshua Tree on a trip and start hammering out the format of the show. So he starts working for Lorne at this point. He's credited by Tom Davis for discovering Franken and Davis because he gave their packet to Lorne and said, we really should look at these guys. So that right there is a lot, a lot to contribute to the show. But then he comes and he just, look, I'm not a huge Chevy Chase fan, but I'm going to read you a Chevy Chase quote because this stood out to me. Chevy Chase is talking about Tom Schiller, and he says, he came up with the ideas and concepts that were far better than most of the sketches being written, and that can be itself more valuable. He rarely sat down at a typewriter and handed in pages of dialogue. And the point of Chevy's thing is, and then he goes on, blah, blah, blah. And he says, you know, he goes on to talk about how Tom helped develop the samurai character, right? So the samurai is something that John had created before the show. Tom's walking down the street with Chevy Chase because they were friends for 30 weeks, as Tom says, when Chevy was on the show. And he got this idea like, oh, we can put that samurai character in different situations and give him different professions. So we can do samurai hotelier, which, you know, that was the Richard Pryor sketch. And he helped develop the idea around samurai. And then Zweibel, I think, is the one that really ran with samurai after that. But those were the types of things that Tom Schiller brought to the show. Was he would bring an idea, and even if he wasn't the one to execute on it, Zweibel had a really good start with this concept that Schiller created. He did a series with Rosie called started with The More Insects to Fear, or Insects, I forget exactly the wording on that one, but it became More Insects to Worry About. And again, it's like this absurdist stuff that he did. So I feel like, aside from the films that he contributed throughout the years, in those first 5 years, he really was someone that helped people up their game on their ideas and brought a different element, because that first season especially, it's very heavy in O'Donohue's influence. And he does a sketch, you know, O'Donohue's all about death. He does a sketch on the Louise Lasser episode called Fooling Death, which is a takeoff of The Seventh Seal, the Swedish film. And it's all, the whole entire sketch is in Swedish with subtitles. And Tom Schiller plays Death, who comes for Chevy Chase and Louise Lasser, who are infatuated with one another. And they ask him to go pick up pizza. Right. And the whole tagline at the end is, so Sven and Inga fooled Death. There is no pizza in Sweden. And that's the sketch. And it's like taking this concept of death coming and making it absurd and doing that, the European sensibility that Schiller loved, is something different. And I think that was really necessary at the time, because you had the writers were O'Donohue and Chevy Chase were kind of entrenched in their style. Franken and Davis were so young and green. I don't think that they really had voices yet. And Schiller was the one who was kind of, he had his own sensibilities and would bring them to light. So even if he wasn't writing a lot of sketches, like Chevy said, he was bringing a lot to the table. And I think he played a large role in SNL getting through those first five seasons and bringing quality to it.
So there's that. What a fantastic episode, wasn't it? Listening to Gary just dig in and talk about all the nuance and history of Tom Schiller, I don't know that it's going to be enough to get him in the Hall of Fame. As Bill mentioned off the top, for some reason, voters don't want to vote in writers and they don't want to vote in musical guests. Now, musical guests, maybe I can forgive, even though you've heard me rant and rave about musical guests over the years. But writers, these are the backbone of the show. this is not an improv show. There are great cast members that are doing wonderful things, but the lines they are reading have been written by writers. And if that doesn't rankle you and make you want to lift your pen and vote for Tom Schiller et al., then I don't know what to tell you. I don't know that you fully appreciate the show. How about that? Listen, you've got unlimited ballots this year. You're going to do it. We're going to put them in. Maybe not Schiller, but we're going to get some writers in there, and it's going to be great. Speaking of great, let's get to a piece. It's not a sketch. It is a Schiller Vision movie, and it comes from 1988. It is, like Bill and Gary said, it is bittersweet because at the time it was really just a wonderful, wonderful homage to Jan Hooks and Phil Hartman. But over the years, because those two have passed, it's become that now. Yeah, that is just a wonderful piece. there's no doubt about the quality of that piece. I encourage you, as it's a very visual piece, to visit YouTube and search for Love is a Dream. It's I can't say enough about it. It's wonderful. And if that is all that Tom Schiller produced, he should be very proud. But again, he produced just a great deal of things. So I want to thank our guest this week, Gary Seeth. You can find his Not Ready for Primetime project on the interwebs, wherever you get fine podcasts. I want to thank our team. I want to thank Bill Kenny. I want to thank Matt Ardill. And of course, I want to thank you for tuning in each and every week and listening to the SNL Hall of Fame podcast. That's what I've got for you this week. If you would do me a favor and on your way out, as you walk past the Weekend Update exhibit, turn out the lights, because the SNL Hall of Fame is now closed.
Thanks for listening to the SNL Hall of Fame podcast. Make sure to rate, review, share, and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on social media at SNLHOF. This is Kirk Lane saying, see you next week.
And such.